May it please the court, Timur Askarov on behalf of Mr. Santos Orantes. I would ask for reserve 2 minutes of time for rebuttal.
Thank you. You may proceed.
I would like to address three issues today. The first is the timeliness of Mr. Orantes' claim. The second is the issue of the abuse of the writ or successive petition. And third, I'd like to touch upon the merits of Mr. Orantes' claim. With respect to the issue of timeliness, the question before the court is whether Mr. Orantes' case falls within the exception provided for in RCW 1073-100, subsection 6, for cases based on changes in law that apply retroactively. In personal restraint of time, the Supreme Court held that Padilla affected a change in law that applies retroactively for purposes of the exception to the time limit in Washington State. In Tsai, the Supreme Court addressed two cases, the case of Petitioner Tsai and Petitioner Jagana. The Supreme Court held that Petitioner...
The state suggests that that retroactivity only applies if there was no advice given about immigration status and that it doesn't address the situation where faulty advice was given. Could you address that?
Yes, and that's precisely where I was going, Your Honor. The state argues that only non-advice claims are actionable. But it's actually not the case that Washington precedent recognized all species of misadvice as bases for the withdrawal of a plea. In fact, as the Supreme Court recognized in Tsai, and I'm citing directly from page 107 in the Tsai opinion, anything short of an affirmative misrepresentation by counsel of the plea's deportation, specifically deportation consequences, could not support the plea's withdrawal. This standard, again, came from the case personal restraint of Yim, where the court stated, the Washington State Supreme Court, that only an affirmative misrepresentation about the possibility of deportation would warrant withdrawal of a plea under pre-Padilla Washington law. Now, there are three cases that illustrate why Mr. Orantes' claim of misadvice would not have been actionable under pre-Padilla Washington case law. The first is Yim itself, the case that announced the standard that I was just referring to, the misrepresentation about the possibility of deportation. In Yim, the defendant was advised by counsel and in his plea form, and I believe by the court, that deportation was a possibility. However, at sentencing, the court and defense counsel made the miscalculation that if a sentence of less than 5 years were imposed, immigration consequences could be avoided. Now, that unfortunately was not the case. The defendant was placed in deportation proceedings, and subsequently when the defendant did move for relief from the conviction, the Supreme Court held that despite this miscalculation in the mitigation strategy, because the defendant was not affirmatively misadvised about the possibility of deportation, the claim was not actionable. Similarly, in the state of Sandoval, this is another clear case of misadvice. We would submit that the Sandoval is, of course, the case that recognized the Padilla standard in Washington. There, the defense attorney advised the client that even though the conviction was deportable, before the defendant was actually deported, he'd be able to hire an immigration attorney and ameliorate any adverse immigration consequences. This advice, of course, was incorrect. This was an aggravated felony that Mr. Sandoval had pleaded to, and so there was no relief to be had in immigration court. On these facts, the Washington State Court of Appeals held that under the Yim standard, because Mr. Sandoval was not misadvised about the possibility of deportation, this misadvice by counsel was not actionable.
So if he wasn't given advice, he didn't rely on advice for purposes of the plea agreement? Is that the underlying reasoning there? That in the absence of advice, he couldn't have relied on that absence? Why? I think our question is, why does the distinction stand up? Misadvice and non-advice?
I don't believe that there's a distinction between misadvice and non-advice. I believe that the very limited circumstances under which a defendant would be able to seek relief under pre-Padilla case law is when counsel says specifically, you will not be deported. Any misadvice less than that is illustrated by the misadvice in Sandoval that was not actionable pre-Padilla and was not actionable in Yim, was insufficient before Padilla to warrant relief. So we don't accept this misadvice, non-advice exception. The what Washington law allowed was very, very limited. It was Washington law allowed relief in cases where the defendant was specifically told you will not be deported. That's not what Mr. Orantes is claiming. Mr. Orantes is, in fact, claiming that there's no argument here that Mr. Orantes was not informed of the possibility of deportation. What was defective is counsel's mitigation advice, specifically that a sentence of 364 days would be sufficient to ameliorate immigration consequences. And that, in fact, was not right. And that case is directly analogous to Sandoval. It's directly analogous to the type of mitigation strategy that was.
If we accept your argument, this case would simply go back to the trial court for a reference hearing. Is that correct?
That is correct. That is what we are
requesting, Your Honor. Would you have to present evidence of the standard of care of counsel at that point, since the second lawyer Mr. Orantes hired also appears to have not understood what needed to happen, which begins to suggest maybe the standard of care out there didn't require the kind of advice that was accurate?
Your Honor, and we would be happy to do that at a reference hearing.
Is that what you're going? Do you contemplate that would be required at the reference hearing if there was one, that you would have to present affirmative evidence of the standard of care back in 2005 or 6, whenever this was taken?
I believe that Padilla, the Padilla opinion, Supreme Court opinion, was pretty clear itself that for 15 years, the opinion was issued in 2010. 15 years takes us back to 1995. The standard has been where the immigration consequences are clear, that counsel has to provide correct advice, and that includes advice about relief from immigration.
Does Padilla proceed on a, you can't say this is collateral, so it's not part of counsel's obligation when representing a defendant in a criminal proceeding?
Padilla doesn't classify this as whether it's a collateral consequence or a direct consequence. It simply says that counsel has had the duty. That's what the standards of care.
Okay, counsel didn't have the duty before Padilla, so Padilla expanded the scope of the standard of care.
Your Honor, that's not our position. I don't believe that's the position that the Washington State Supreme Court has taken. Our Supreme Court has said that since 1983, since the enactment of RCW 10-4200.
Let's make a distinction between the rule in Washington. Padilla sets a national standard under the federal Constitution.
And so more specifically, Your Honor, the standard in Padilla was we look to professional norms. That's a Strickland standard. And so certainly if that's the requirement that the court finds, we would be happy to present it. It's our position that even back in 2006, this was the standard, because Padilla had said that this has been the standard for at least the past 15 years. This was the standard required by the American Bar Association and other professional organizations from which we derive standards of care.
You've got 2 minutes left if you sit down now. If you keep talking, I'm going to start the clock.
I would ask to reserve the remainder of my time, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, Tessa Fine, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney for Snohomish County, representing the respondent of the State of Washington. The first issue before the Court today is this petition timely or is it time barred? And that reduces to, does it fall within the exception for a significant change of law? Now, a significant change of law is defined in Rates I and other cases. It exists when an intervening opinion has effectively overturned a prior appellate decision that was originally determinative of a material issue.
Our acting chief judge already dismissed this once, and the Supreme Court accepted review and sent it back for us. Doesn't that suggest they think we got it wrong?
I would suggest that this court failed to take into account the decision in Rates I, which is obvious because that decision came down after the acting chief judge's ruling.
But if we appropriately considered Tsai as you characterize it, wouldn't we get to the same result?
Apparently, yeah. Yes, we would.
So why would the Supreme Court put us through all of that rather than just refusing to accept review?
Now, what? I don't think that we can speculate about the motivation for the Supreme Court's decision, but where an appellate court has failed to take into account a significant decision affecting the area, I think it's common for a higher court to say, well, take a look at this decision and see how it affects us without deciding for itself what the ultimate result would be. So that's where we are now. We're remanded for consideration in light of Tsai. This court previously just took the flat view that Padilla doesn't establish a significant change in law, or excuse me, Padilla is not retroactively applicable, was this court's prior decision.
Actually, this court decided in another case that Padilla was retroactive, and we got reversed on that.
I believe the court's holding in this specific case.
Not on this case, but in another case, in another panel that I sat on, authored by Judge Cox, we found Padilla retroactive, and the Supreme Court disagreed with us. And then that's the U.S. Supreme Court.
Yes, and there is no question that there have been a number of conflicting decisions, but ultimately we're here to apply Tsai. As I said, you know, Tsai lays down as a decision of whether there was a prior appellate decision that was originally determinative, and they cite to their prior decision in In re Greening. And Greening explains that counsel have a duty to raise arguments that are available, but not those that are essentially unavailable. So the question is, prior to the decision in Padilla, was an argument of ineffectiveness available under the facts of this case? Not whether it was as strong an argument as it later became, not whether that argument was certain to prevail, but whether it was sufficiently available that it could be raised without conflicting with any then existing appellate decisions. And the answer to that question is clearly yes, it was available under prior law. And Tsai, in fact, says so.
But didn't prior law circumscribe the scope of the ineffective assistance?
Yes, but not in a way that limited the matter.
If you look, counsel's argument seems to be if you gave absolutely incorrect advice, that was available. But if you gave incomplete advice or something short of directly wrong advice, that wasn't available. That's where he draws the line. And that's where you disagree, isn't it?
I don't think that's a correct line drawing, but in any event,
Where do you think the line was?
The line was between giving no advice and giving advice that is affirmatively incorrect. But even if you say absolutely incorrect advice is the standard, that the allegations in this case fall under that standard. And look back at State v. Stow, the 1993 case, where the court held that incorrect advice is to a collateral consequence, their ability to avoid discharge from the Army was a proper basis for ineffective assistance, and they quoted with approval from an Illinois case as follows. Counsel's erroneous representation that guilty plea would not affect defendant's immigration status or immigrant status was ineffective assistance and rendered guilty plea involuntary. So that's okay.
For you to be correct, would we have to weigh the evidence? We have two different descriptions of what transpired from the declaration of counsel and the declaration of Ms. Arantes. The counsel says at no point during her conversations did she advise him that the plea would likely result in the loss of his immigration status. Now, he goes on and describes what he characterizes as wrong advice, but she doesn't say that she gave wrong advice. She says she didn't advise him about a particular matter.
Well,
so do we have to weigh the evidence then to get to where you want us to go?
All we have to do is accept the defendant's allegations, which were the basis of his complaint.
Well, we don't usually do that. We usually look at the record to see if there's something more there.
Well, Your Honor, I guess, are you being asked then to decide this case on the basis that the defendant was lying and that he didn't receive advice, which he says that he did receive, and
he could have a faulty
on
memory after 10 years rather than being lying.
He could, but I would also point out that counsel's affidavit is a little bit evasive. She doesn't say that she gave him no advice on the topic. She says she didn't advise him that the plea would subject to deportation. And of course, if she advised him, as the defendant's claim, that the plea would not affect his immigration status, then that would mean she didn't advise him that the plea would be subject him to deportation. There isn't any conflict between these two affidavits. And again, the issue is not whether the defendant would have gotten relief on a pre-Padilla petition. The issue is, was his claim available to him? And where he is claiming that he received affirmative misadvice, and the case of State v. Stowe expressly recognized that an affirmative misadvice claim could establish ineffectiveness. You know, just compare what he declared with what Stowe says is a sufficient allegation to warrant relief. You can see they are the same. This claim was available. Now,
how could it be available, even in light of prior cases that held that immigration, at least prior to Padilla, that immigration was a collateral consequence? There was no such case that applied in Stowe to the advice that he was given.
No.
Well, it's a different circumstance, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a different circumstance, but the court, but the advice in the issue, the subject matter in Stowe, that is, the defendant's discharge from the U.S. Army as a result of the conviction, was clearly a collateral consequence. The court in Stowe said so, considered an argument that because it was collateral, it didn't matter and couldn't be ineffective, rejected that argument, expressly distinguished between non-advice on a collateral matter and affirmative advice and misadvice on a collateral matter, and expressly analogized that to affirmative misadvice about immigration consequences. Now, counsel is suggesting that somehow there is a difference between advice about deportation and advice about other lesser immigration consequences. Well, Tsai doesn't say that. It says incorrect advice about immigration consequences. Stowe doesn't say that. It says, again, misrepresentations about immigration consequences. And in any event, that distinction is immaterial to this case. The alleged advice was this plea won't affect your status. Obviously, if your immigration status is not affected, then you won't be deported. And the defendant's allegation is that, in reality, his status is affected to the point where deportation is essentially certain, he says, if this is not set aside. So that distinction is faulty. This defendant was, according to his allegations, incorrectly told that he would not be deported if, as a result of this plea. I would like to talk very briefly about abuse of the writ. We have a situation here where a defense counsel, knowing full well that an ineffectiveness claim is available post-Padilla, chooses not to raise that claim and relies on due process instead. And his justification is, well, I thought that a ineffectiveness claim might have been time-barred. The problem is that the claim he raised, the due process claim, equally depended on Padilla, equally depended on persuading the court that Padilla was a significant change in the law and was retroactive. And by raising this claim, by failing to raise this claim, he's got a bunch of unfair tactical advantages, postponed the state's discovery, two bites at the apple, and of course, he's delayed his deportation at this point for some 3 years as a result of splitting his claim. The court should hold that in abuse of the writ and dismiss the petition.
Very briefly, back to this issue of misadvice and non-advice.
Why don't you talk about the last issue, the abuse of writ, and why? And there was an express disclaimer of ineffective assistance in the pleadings filed with the first writ, and Padilla is an ineffective assistance of counsel case. So why shouldn't the other claim have been made? Why isn't the disavowal of the claim precluded being brought now?
So it was not the case that the ineffective assistance of counsel claim was initially raised and then disclaimed or abandoned.
It was not raised at all.
And counsel proceeded on a due process theory, believing, based on this court's precedent in Olivera Avila about the retroactivity of advising clients or courts advising defendants about direct consequences, that requirement was retroactive. That's what the theory that counsel proceeded on.
Mr. Fine's point is that you couldn't read Padilla and not know the ineffective assistance of counsel claim was available.
But you could also read Padilla and believe that it was not available because of the restrictions on collateral attacks under RCW 10-73090, the one-year time bar. Now, what the cases do hold, in Ray Jeffries, Greening, is that it is not an abuse of the writ when a defendant raises an issue that where there has been a change in law, a material change in law. The material change in law is the retroactivity case law.
In Jagana, which case is the Sun. Material change?
The material change was this court's opinion in Jagana that says claims under Padilla are not time barred, and subsequently the Supreme Court's decision in Tsai. That's the change that has opened the door to this ineffective assistance of counsel claim in our view. And therefore, because of the change in law, Mr. Orantes' motion is not abusive. Thank you.
Thank you. Next case this morning is Morgan versus Hebert.